You're listening to Beyond the Archives with the creative research team on Origin, Ways of Being. Stories. Through them we escape, we learn, and we are inspired. We take a journey. In September 2024, the creative research team started a lab for living at Sheffield Hallam University to develop stories for the Ways of Being online museum to optimise cultural experiences for mental health in underrepresented young people. Origin Ways of Being is an Oxford research project funded by NIHR. This meant going into archives and supporting others to do so to search for people and artefacts that told a story. We hope to share some with you and that they moved you like they moved us. But if they didn't, we hope that the stories inspire you to investigate the archives for yourselves and find stories that are meaningful to you. In this series, we delve into the politics of archives, narratology and mental health, reflecting on our creative process and the challenges of unearthing and retelling stories from the past. Join us as we navigate the complexities of storytelling and the power of archives to shape how we understand ourselves, others, and the world around us. Take a pew and have a listen. We'd love to hear your thoughts. So today we welcome to the podcast Kerry and Jamie. Hello, Kerry and Jamie.
Hello.
So you've both been previous guests on the podcast before, but we've not spoken so much about some other aspects of your work. Could you tell me a little bit about your interactions with archives previously, and especially your interest, now Jamie in particular, in archival politics, and Kerry in archival justice?
Okay, thank you. So my background is I'm a history graduate, so my first interaction with the archives came in final year when I was doing a project about a Edwardian drag king called Vesta Tilly, and I went into the fairground and circus archives. And since then, just in my like personal interests, I've been following a lot of really interesting archival justice projects who I'll talk a bit more about in the podcast, and whose work is really interesting and has really opened my eyes up to politics, the violence, the suppression of the archives, but also the joys, because that sounds really depressing.
So my name is Jamie. I am an English literature graduate. I think I spoke about this in my previous episode. So my interactions with archives is that I volunteered in the librarian at Glasgow University, where I basically did tours for the Antonine Wall exhibit, which led me to become interested in museums and the flip side of museums, which is like special collections and archives and that kind of stuff. So I did a little bit of voluntary work in Barnsley Local Studies and Archives, and I currently do a little bit of volunteering at the University of Sheffield's Archives and Special Collections Department, essentially cataloguing and writing the scope and content for particular collections that the lovely collections manager gives me.
I think it's safe to say that you probably have the most experience directly with archives in the team.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. Mm. But I'm no professional, so please don't take any of my opinions as gospel.
Yeah,
as gospel.
No, fantastic. I think it's really good to speak about this because the project as a whole obviously is about going into archives and asking young people to do so too, to find narratives that have been in some way hidden or suppressed, and then kind of creatively reproducing them on a platform to support young people's mental health. But I think when I first came to this project, I had the question, what is an archive? Because I think it is a little bit muddied sometimes between what is an archive, what's a collection, what's a museum, and why.
Yeah.
So I might just come to you, Jamie, first of all, with what is an archive?
So also I think it's important to understand as well that particular institutions, based off of the kind of archival material they collect, will often have different kind of, like, I suppose, logics and principles. There's particular principles of archiving, hence why you need to do a whole master's to become a kind of a qualified archivist, because there is a particular kind of it's a particular area of study, almost as science. But as to what an archive is, I'll read out this, which is called the Universal Declaration on Archives, which is a statement put out by the International Council on Archives, which defines archives as, quote, a unique and irreplaceable heritage passed from one generation to another. Archives are managed from creation to preserve their value and meaning. They are authoritative sources of information underpinning accountable and transparent administrative actions. They play an essential role in the development of societies by safeguarding and contributing to individual and community memory. Open access to archives enriches our knowledge of human society, promotes democracy, protects citizens' rights, and enhances quality of life. End quote. So I think archival justice and archival politics as well, which I think to the two terms probably basically speak to the same values and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I would say that archival justice, and Kerry, feel free to like butt in if you've got anything else to say about it, is the principle of using this record keeping and of archives and acknowledging that archiving and archives are not a neutral space. And yeah, like I said, the record keeping of this social, scientific and economic history, and using that to sort of challenge inequalities and promote social justice and restitution for marginalised communities. Because I think historically there's this idea that archives were created out of a sense of prestige and sort of documenting things to be deemed to be of sort of like higher cultural and political importance. But like movements like archival justice and sort of archival futurism is looking, seeking to look beyond this practice. And I think that archivists and sort of archives as a whole are looking to kind of move more into that kind of practice and space.
Mm. I think you kind of you problematized that quote quite a lot there, and I kind of find that even when I was like reading it through and thinking, especially they are authoritative sources of information underpinning accountable and transparent administrative processes or actions, and the idea that they play a role in safeguarding and contributing to individual and collective memory, which I'm not disputing that happens, but I think it's very important actually to note how archives come into being in the first place, what material has a privilege being in the archive, but also kind of what material doesn't make it into a museum. I was wondering, could you differentiate between kind of what's gets placed in an archive? An archive is somewhere where there are many different documents, many different objects that are stored over time for varying different reasons. Why is not all of it in a museum? What's the... Did the thing shift in and out of an archive and go into museums? Like, what's the relationship?
So I probably can't speak to this with extreme levels of accuracy, so please forgive me.
We will.
Dear listeners, and obviously you both for that. But I suppose one of the differences... So the difference as well between like an archive and a library is the archival material is unpublished for the most part, and library material is published. So typically in an archive you'll see ledgers, letters, deeds, but that's also, it's not restricted to that either. There'll be objects, there'll be all sorts. Some institutions will differentiate between their archives and their special collections, and then some will class all of their special collections within, and other collections as well. So for example, at University of Sheffield, we've got the special collections, and then we've got the National Fairground and Circus Archives, which is a separate collection. So it's okay to be confused about these things. I also am, and I've been working, or volunteering at least, or exposed to archives in a voluntary capacity for a little while, so it is confusing. But archival material and special collections basically refer to, as is in the name, specialised historical material that are stored separately from library collections and are not accessible without appointment. So some of this material, yeah, might be exhibited in a museum. The material to be looked at is typically handled in a reading room or a research space, and often cannot leave this space unless they're out on exhibition. They're hierarchical, so each... Their catalogue, I'll talk about the catalogue. So they have this, they have the way that they're catalogued, the way that you find their information, they're unique catalogues that basically aim to preserve the logic of the material by arranging it in accordance with a few factors, such as provenance, which basically refers to the chronological history of the object, its acquisition, its reason for creation, and the history of its use, and original order. So the order in which the collection's creator originally arranged it before it was given to the archive to preserve and keep. And to speak broadly, in the past, both the preservation and accessing of these records has been subject to sort of politicised gatekeeping. So, and both also what goes on display at a museum, what is goes out of storage essentially and is put on display, that also all has reasons and stuff which have historically not been acknowledged or just been kind of in keeping with the status quo and been sort of like unquestioned. So there's this really fantastic article by Sarah Ball called Reading, Writing and Publishing an Obscene Canon, The Archival Logic of the Secret Museum, in it, and in which she discusses how, and I'm going to quote her here, In the mid-19th to early 20th century, access to the private case, which was essentially a British collection of obscene, quote-unquote, material, so pornography and erotica, dating from the early Victorian period, and this material was restricted only to gentlemen scholars who acquired knowledge of the collection through elite social networks, the only readers considered appropriately equipped to survey the materials it housed. So the collection flattened this kind of like these works into this category of dangerous material, and like for obvious reasons and like ways of being, we are not dealing with erotic stories. But like as a principle, I just think it's like worth thinking about if the collection item like you, you Kerry and Sophie, or you, if you yourself are going into an arc, the principles, the item you're drawing a story from, whether it's had its access restricted, whether sort of historically or contemporarily, and what those reasons will be. And I think Ball's term, secret museum, is just a good way of thinking about an archive.
It's fascinating how many different layers there are to an archive.
Yeah.
There are so many different, it feels like there are kind of like fields it passes through all that material, in which you have the first question of like, what has importance to go into an archive, and importance with quote marks there, like who gets to decide what is an essential part of history,
or yeah,
what needs to be remembered. And you know, I think the quote was sort of like passed on for generations, unique and irreplaceable heritage,
yeah,
like who decides what that is about a community or about a society,
exactly,
that gets put in an archive.
And you have many different types, you know, you've got personal archives, so it'll just be one person's kind of collection, and then you have corporate archives, so like banks and stuff, which often house historical, it's just kind of like numerical record keeping, and I don't know anything about money, guys, I'm going to be real with you, I really don't know anything about money, I don't know anything what corporate archives do, I just know that they exist. And then of course you've got sort of like cultural archives, and archives associated with museums and particular institutions, like often universities and stuff like that. But the stuff that finds its way there and is considered important enough to kind of like be preserved or be considered part of a collection is obviously like not neutral.
I think often what's written, what's in archives is written material. I was going to bring you, Kerry, in. You're interested in like oral histories, because
yeah.
I think that feels like, at least from my very limited perspective, that there is more of a like an accepted term to oral history being like an extremely valid form of narratizing like culture and community.
Yeah.
But it does feel like in an archive generally it's written material.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like that also speaks to the different ways of doing history, and sort of two of the ways when I sort of think about how history has been historically recorded, in my mind I always think about there's sort of the, well no, there's lots of different ways of doing history, but like two of the main ones is sort of the professional historian, which came about in the 18th century with sort of the rise of universities, which is a very academic, quote-unquote scientific, quote-unquote unbiased, even though they are very biased, sort of rigorous way of doing history. And then another way of doing history is the sort of more, I don't know, I think it's got a longer history, oral traditions of passing down stories. And that, but that is a lot more casual. It's often done by societies or groups who are not deemed as like professional or not deemed as having their stories be valuable enough to be put in archives. And so I think because of the way history is done, and obviously the sort of tight linking of archive, sort of archiving as a practice and history as a practice, means that they sort of feed into each other, and that sort of means that archives are more often than not made up of written material, sort of letters by great men versus stories that people tell each other. And
there is cassettes and stuff like that, so there is kind of audiovisual, but again it has to be kind of material that's been, it's not oral history, it's like put into a kind of like analog like sort of item to record that.
And it'll often be in an interview format, so it'll be like an archivist or historian who is doing this interview, and it's often a very professional, it's very sort of professional, it's very and it also means that the person who is recording this interview will have chosen this other person because they think their story is valuable. Like for example, in the Imperial War Museum archives, they have lots of recorded interviews that I was sort of doing some research into, and it was with young people. Some of the ones that I was looking into was young people who survived the Holocaust. And it was getting me thinking because there were some of them that I could find in there and some of them that I couldn't when I was sort of putting names into the archive search function. And it was making me think about, like, who did this researcher in the sort of, I think it was the 1980s, like, who did she decide was the person, the people that she was going to interview?
Mm.
But there are some really interesting archiving projects that are trying to roll back that sort of erasure of oral history.
Mm.
I feel like I should also say oral history is often sort of more often than not associated with sort of historical working class people. Mm. But basically, there's a really cool archive called the Bantu Archive, which was established in Sadaka, which is the Sheffield African and Caribbean District Community Association.
Good remembrance.
Thank you very much, it's a very long acronym. And it's a really cool archive, and they basically founded it because they wanted to tell the stories of the people who helped create Sadaka and the people who frequent Sadaka and who use it. And the archivist who is at the head of it, she's really amazing. And she has, they're all on SoundCloud, and she just interviews people who have been part of Sadaka or helped form it, and all of the interviews are they've been cut into very short different bits, so they'll be about 10 minutes long. And because they're on SoundCloud, they feel like incredibly accessible.
Mm.
Like, you can find them so easily, you can scroll through and it'll be like so-and-so talking about the creation of Sadaka, and it just feels a lot more of an accessible way of archiving.
Mm.
Yeah.
There is something there about accessibility of archives, I think, that I know through my very limited history, as in the last couple of months of looking through archives through this project, I found so many fascinating things by accident, because I've asked to see something and it's just had a little bit of a written note on it or something, and I've gone, I've actually not, it says paper, is it a letter, is it a poem, what is that? Or maybe I've had an experience when, I think you did as well, but we both had experience of the archivist being like, oh, I never knew that was in in this archive.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I'm going to chat about that. What was yours?
Mine was with the Simmons stuff, where I saw it at the John Ryland Institute, and the email I got back after requesting to see the material. So there's correspondences between Walt Whitman and John Addington Simmons in the Ryland Institute, and the archivist got back to me and was like, when I was asking to have the appointment to go and see the material, they were like, yeah, like, of course you can. Also, didn't even realise we had any John Addington Simmons, and they have an LGBT histories collection, and they were like, well, think about adding it to that collection. So thanks for bringing it to light. So some of them, you know, there's a lot of stuff in archives. Archives that are typically, you know, old, have been maintained for hundreds of years. So even contemporary ones are quite old.
I think there's something to be said in that story about how an archive only becomes alive if it gets used.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Like, if people don't access archives, and if archives are inaccessible, confusing, they feel too fancy for people to go down, which more often than not they do, then the things that are in there will slowly die.
Yeah.
Not literally, because the archivists will look after them, I'm sure, but their reasons and their purposes and sort of, I don't know, whatever the sort of, I don't know, the spirit of the object is, will sort of slowly fade away.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
I think it was in your podcast episode where you spoke about Amber spoke about the haptic
encounter, the experience.
Which is a word I'd never heard of before, which I think is fantastic. Of just, you can explain it.
Holding the John Addington Simmons is, if you haven't seen that previous episode, but his biography, his autobiography essentially, the editor of him, I had a chat with, she was my old university professor. Thank you, Amber, for the chat. She said that when it was placed in front of her, this big autobiography, and obviously it'd been placed under, it had an embargo and stuff on it for a long time, and he risked a lot, Simmons, to write it. And when it was placed in front of her and she got to touch it and sort of like open it up and see the sort of like smudges and even drops of blood, she said in some spaces, like, it was overwhelmingly emotional. It was an overwhelmingly emotional experience. And I think that is also, because I think sometimes people are like, why should I care that like this stuff even exists in this place? And I think that's a difficult question to answer, I think. And I think it's probably individual and independent. And I also think that, of course, there's much to care about in archives.
Mm.
And archives, that's too broad, it's too broad a term really, but there's something for everyone in one.
Just have to find it first. I think I said when I went to view, it was meant to be about, so Isabella Banks was a poet and a writer from the 19th century, and I wanted to view, her husband had quite a difficult life whilst they were together. He was struggling with his mental health for a long period of time, and there was meant to be a letter written to him about it, and I wanted to go and see that because it not only felt important about his life, but also felt important to what Isabella was kind of managing in her lifetime as well, whilst she was writing, whilst she was actually the sole breadwinner of that family, but through writing, you know, being a woman in the 19th century. I thought that was super cool. And then I went in and I thought I was just going to get one sheet of paper, and I got the biggest stack that was falling apart, and but it was really overwhelming yeah. in a way of like, there's information about so many people's lives that I'm just pulling out of this box.
Yeah.
And I felt like it felt really difficult to open, and everything was in, you know, cursive, and it's I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah.
It wasn't a bad overwhelm. It was just, I think I'm gonna tackle this at another day. But it felt really special to be able to kind of hold it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something about when you look at, which are like, I feel like we've done a lot, when you look at sort of an archive web page and you say you find an archive about someone that you're interested in, you scroll down, you're like, oh, I wonder how much they've got on them, and you know, at first you're like, oh, I hope they have a lot, and then you see it says like 25 boxes and you're like, no. There's something about going to an archive and they're like, and here's one and another and another and another, then you're like, oh god,
yeah,
I want to read all this.
I mean, being able to sort of like accurately request the material is honestly a skill I feel like I only got up through trial and error. So like being able to know really what I was looking for and stuff like that, like, and how to search a catalogue, which hopefully our co-design kit will answer. If it doesn't, oh no. But
don't come back.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, and obviously there's really interesting things, particularly in talking about sort of like archival justice in keyword searching catalogues and keyword searching scope and contents, because I think that was one thing that our other member of the Ways of Being team, Joe, me and him had a conversation about keyword searching, and sometimes if you're looking for, like, say, as an example, LGBT histories, if you type in LGBT or like gay or trans, those terms don't yield anything. But however, if you type in historically pejorative terms, those will yield those histories, because they've been, their scope and content reflect the nature of the material, which is often pejorative in itself, or bigoted, or have medicalized what we now know are just sort of like sexual orientations and gender identities. So that's also something to sort of like consider and look out for as well.
I think they reflect the times in which they've been catalogued, right?
Or they just reflect the contents.
Yeah.
They try and accurately reflect the content of the material and the scope of content written by the archivist, which might reflect potentially that those terms might be trying to instead reflect the language used in that particular material, just in the scope and contents. So the scope and content is the little bit that describes what's in this layer of the, it's really complicated. Like, I feel like some of this stuff is really complicated to talk about. Layer of the like description level, essentially.
And I think there is a difference between types of archives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are archives that are, I don't know, quite more active. That
yeah.
Have like the curators are pulling things out all the time, and they kind of get recatalogued and
things
like that. Whereas I think I came across some items that the way in which the scoping content was talking about mental health, for instance, I found very challenging and difficult, and I was like, oh my, but it was reflective of how that person who was cataloguing it, I think it was like 80 years ago, at the terms that were used at that time, which now would that's actually very harmful. But hadn't been redone, hadn't been looked at since,
or at least had that like language acknowledged as kind of like acceptable in a contemporary, or, you know, the record hasn't been updated. That's a good way of putting it. The record has yet to be updated and hasn't been updated. And often as well, that's because just from time spent in an archive space, there's not enough time to do any of that. Like, obviously, like, archives are notoriously underfunded. So there's not enough time and money for everyone to sort of rectify the records. But does that make it any less important? No, it does not.
I think a good example of an active archive is the Sheffield City Archives. And a really good example of how they're doing it is the head archivist there. Pretty sure she's the head archivist there. Her name's Cheryl. And she's working with a project called Dig Where You Stand, which is sort of the three sort of people at the head of that are Desiree Reynolds, a poet, Cheryl from Sheffield City Archives, and a guy called Alex from University of Sheffield. And they're basically working to go through Sheffield City Archives to find evidence of global majority and black people in Sheffield before Windrush. Mm. And I think it's really great seeing what they do, and especially seeing the way they go back into Sheffield City Archives, and like they have to do proper trawling. Mm. And I'm sure they have to like think of really clever ways to find people's names, and so often because people will have been marginalised in the archives, there's so little information about them. Mm-hmm. And the way that they're sort of producing their research is through art, and had a really great exhibition about 6 months ago. And there were lots of really great pieces of work produced from people that they found in the archives, but one of the things that really struck me was there was this one artist, and she produced some work, and me and a group got a tour around the gallery. Mm-hmm. And Alex told us that she actually had a really hard time going into the archives because she was shocked and disappointed by how little global majority people were in there. Mm-hmm. Like, she was hoping to sort of find sort of lots of snippets of people mm-hmm. and things before Windrush, but she found very little, and if she did find names, it was just somebody's name. And she was really disappointed and angered by the sort of violence of the archives and its sort of silencing.
I think there are lots of different examples of archival injustices. Often they're about understanding the wishes of those who have passed. So people who have passed away, and their information or aspects of them, kind of objects about their life, have then been passed to an archive. But and in lots of those situations that's happened. I know for mine it's been a lot of the objects and artifacts that I've looked at have been donated by family members, and it's thinking about, did that person want that information to be handled by an archive or kept in an archive? I know we spoke about on the episode that Beth was in about Anne Lister, and her diaries were decoded. Did she actually want that to happen, or was it quite a private thing that they actually were never meant to be decoded? But yeah, I wonder if you have anything to say about kind of those archival injustices at all.
So with archival injustices, or just kind of like the question and the restitution of people's kind of like records and memories, and in this case, bodies, in the case study I thought we'd sort of like look at and consider, is the case of, and I'm really unsure of how to say his last name, Byrnes. I'm going to say Byrnes. Again, I really apologise if that's not how it's pronounced. But we'll start at the beginning. So Charles Byrnes was born in Littlebridge in the north of Ireland in 1761. He lived with the conditions known today as agromegaly, or giganticism. So he grew to be 7 foot 7 inches tall, and in the last years of his life made a living exhibiting himself as the Irish giant in Edinburgh and London. He died in 1783, aged 22. It was said that to prevent his body being seized by anatomists, he wanted to be buried at sea. Byrne was living in London at the time, at the same time as the surgeon and anatomist John Hunter. So Hunter had a reputation for collecting quote-unquote unusual specimens for his private museum, and Hunter had offered to pay Byrne for his corpse. As Byrne's health, I just said his name in two completely different ways, but basically as Byrne's health deteriorated, and knowing that Hunter wanted his body for dissection, a fate reserved at that time for executed criminals prior to the Anatomy Act, and he wanted to display his body in his collection, Byrne devised a plan. He made express oral arrangements with friends that when he died, his body would be sealed in a lead coffin and taken to the coastal town of Margate, and then to a ship for burial at sea. But Byrne's wishes were thwarted and his worst fears realised when Dr. Hunter arranged for his cadaver to be snatched on its way to Margate. Hunter's intervention is reported to have cost him £500 for his for the acquisition of Charles's body. And 3 years later, Hunter displayed Byrne's skeleton in his Leicester Square Museum. So the London Hunterian Museum, showcasing the collections of Scottish surgeon Dr. John Hunter, released a statement in January of 2023. This was where his body remained on display until 2023. So a long time.
So up until quite late. I thought it was before.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, long time. But the London Hunterian Museum had this statement, made this statement. During the 5-year period of closure of the Hunterian Museum, due to COVID, the Board of Trustees of the Hunterian Collection reviewed and discussed the sensitivities and the differing views surrounding the display and retention of Charles Burns' skeleton. The trustees, with the approval of the Council of the Royal College of Surgeons of England, agreed that Charles Burns' skeleton will not be displayed in the new Hunterian Museum. The skeleton will be retained as it is an integral part of the Hunterian Collection and will be available for, oh my god, how do I say this word? Bona fide? Bona fide research into the conditions of agromegaly and giganticism. So, really, what of Charles Burns' final wish? So, official response, condensed for brevity, is, like I said, they recognise the sensitivities, the anecdotal references to Charles Burns' wishes are well documented, although no written evidence exists. Mm. The importance of Hunter's collection rests in its entirety. The skeleton of Charles Burns is an integral part of the collection RCSHC Osteo 223 and is therefore covered by these conditions. That the preparation shall be kept in a state of preservation and the collection in as perfect a state as possible, at the expense of the Corporation of Surgeons, subject to the annual inspection and superintendence of the trustees. So what they're saying essentially is that regardless of Charles Burns' final wishes, which have been well corroborated, although, well, as they acknowledged, never written down, crucially never written to any kind of legally actionable document, they intend to retain his body within the Lincoln's Inns Fields archives for the purpose of research. So,
but one thing that is very interesting, because you've sort of told this case study to us before,
yeah,
is that there is a lot of differing opinions about what should be done with his body now, and probably one of the most important opinions comes from his John Burns direct and descendants.
Yeah, it's quite. Again, I'll give Sophie some links as well. There's a few kind of like BBC articles that you can read. And I won't necessarily completely speak for them, but there's more nuance to their opinion as to what should be done with his body and in what state his body should exist and where it should be kept, how it should be treated. They don't necessarily believe that his wishes should be honoured, because I think it's really interesting that they don't find it quite as cut and dry, because I also don't find it cut and dry completely, but I do think that what happened to him was such a violence, and I think that he was so frightened about his body being kind of like desecrated in this way and taken as a kind of and made a specimen of, that he arranged for himself to be put in a lead coffin and then buried at sea and everything like that.
It's so fascinating as well that was a fear within his life.
Yeah.
That he was so conscious of and wanted to put every safeguard in place that would not happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it fits into the larger kind of histories and entanglements that the archives
have
with the medical profession,
yeah,
especially in the UK and with universities, actually,
oh, yeah,
I'm thinking of. So
the acquisition of bodies and also, obviously, like everyone knows, with museums, sort of like quote unquote cultural material, so just basically sort of like things that have been acquired through colonial or imperial practice and stolen, and really in a museum has such is made just a thing to observe, and I just think that obviously I think it's a very, I think it's a more broadly and widely accepted view now that has to be rectified in some way. The archives are so sort of like, and I think that's why it's such kind of an interesting provocation in that, like, it's no longer on display, so it's now got, like, the archive, like I said earlier, things that whose display can't be rehabilitated, and so we acknowledge that we shouldn't be, like, ogling at his body, but instead now it's kept presumably in a drawer somewhere for kind of bespoke research, which is of course important. Bespoke medical research is of course important, particularly for people living with the condition that he lived with. I just also think that whether to say, of course I'm no expert on whether this is the correct course, but I just think that it's an interesting thing to think about.
I guess it probes the big question of, just because something is put in an archive and hidden, is that worse or is that better? Mm. And that sort of speaks to that phrase that you sort of spoke about earlier, like the secret museum.
Mm.
And it's like, what are the ethics of something being hidden away? Is it better? Is it worse? Like, and I feel like that's something we're constantly asking when we're looking at all these objects that we're examining and when we're putting them into the Ways of Being platform.
Mm.
Yeah. And I think it obviously speaks, his body was kept largely for like medical research, for advancing sort of treatments and understandings of different conditions. I think but was also there is that idea of like what do we keep that's deemed unusual,
mm-hmm.
and like as you say, as to be put on as a spectacle. I think whilst I was engaging with like Isabella Banks's work, as like a prominent Victorian, I found her curiosity collection, as she termed it, you know, and that was a very common Victorian almost pastime.
Oh yeah, the antiquarian practice was rife.
And a lot of these things have ended up then in archives, so a lot of that practice has kind of been pre-done and then put in an archive, and it's interesting trying to really detangle where that object has come from and what's its journey into this place, and a lot of that might be the violence kind of inherent within that somewhere maybe. But I think maybe also stepping, there's a lot of joy in an archive and a lot to be discovered.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think it's just important to think through and wholly about it all when we're engaging with it's difficult to describe what an archive is, really, isn't it? With a compendium of knowledge, knowledge that has been espoused by different people over different time, kept by different people, privileged by different people, deprioritized by other people over you know, centuries.
Mm.
How do we account for all of that journey, all of that violence, all of that not actually violence, you know, projects that are trying to really shine a light on histories that have been hidden, or narratives that have been not put at the forefront as well.
Mm.
Or even just when we've got names of individuals that lived in the past in passing, and then you dig a little bit further and you manage to find something out about this person, it's a really, really beautiful thing. But I think in the context of Ways of Being as well, you know, we're looking at trying to tell stories about people, and I don't think there's any justice to not include some of this when we're talking about it, because, you know, inherent in a story, it's not all lovely. There's always going to be trials, and I think it is important to put what we're talking about in context, because these are, you know, real people or real artifacts that people had through history.
Yeah. Like, there's an American academic called Hazel Carby, who has a lovely little quote that says that archives should be a space for alternative realities and alternative ways of knowing. And I think that that's also a thing that Ways of Being is attempting, hopefully succeeding in doing.
I think the good thing about this project is it's allowed us to combine sort of archival research, historical accuracy, with some creative license. We get to be creative, and we get to create these alternative realities, and we get to think about both the story, why the story is where it is, and we get to get creative. And I do think things like Ways of Being is kind of the perfect example of making an archive alive and using it for interesting, good, cool stuff.
Yeah.
I like the last bit of Hazel's quote, there should be room for imagining a world in which justice, not injustice, triumphs.
Yeah. I think it's a, because of course the archive houses extreme acts of kind of injustice, but by that, those, you need to look at that stuff as well, because it kind of enriches, it challenges sort of like narratives, universal narratives that we've just come to kind of accept, and sort of power structures that we feel are kind of unshakable.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's like Dig Where You Stand. Like,
exactly.
Their whole point is that they're trying to find evidence that there have been Black people living in Britain and in Sheffield and in Rotherham for a lot longer than just Windrush.
Mm.
And like, they're using the archives for justice, truth, honesty to triumph, which is, especially now in the sort of current political climate, so important.
Extremely so, yeah.
Mm.
Thank you very much, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sophie.
Yeah.